Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Christine Williams.
And you're listening to Fiber Talk, the weekly podcast for people who play with needles. I really like that.
I know.
I really
and
do.
We have a great guest this week.
We do. Teresa Baird is with us. And Teresa is her business is hi Teresa. Her business is Hearts. You got to be careful when you say this. Hearts Ease Exemplar Works. How'd I do?
That's wonderful.
Yeah, you got this Old England Exemplar, Exemplar, and then Works with an E on the end. Works with
yes.
an ES.
Yes.
You went culture on us.
That's how I am.
Yeah,
I like the lettering from that era, so that's what inspired me to go with the design. But actually, the name of my company came from the fact that stitching in and of itself eases my heart. And so Heart's Ease, and it's also a flower that I love, Heart's Ease. It's like a pansy, like a Johnny Jump Up. Kind of pansy. And I've always liked it. Originally, years ago, I said to my husband, we ought to name our house. We'll name it Heartsease, like that. Mm-hmm. And people laughed at me, you know, like naming your house. But people did used to name their houses. But anyway, for some reason, I've always liked that name. So that's how my company got its name, Heartsease.
And for those who don't know, we should explain, for those who don't know, Teresa's with us because reproduction samplers. She cross-stitch and she does, her sampler designs are inspired by antique reproduction or antique samplers. And that, for me, that is an area I just find, I know very little about, and so Teresa's going to fill us in tonight. But, that whole world of those old samplers that little girls used to do, is just fascinating to me. I just think that's incredible. So,
and I think this is one of the few that I have some experience with because this is how I learned as a child. You know, after I learned my first embroidery was sewing on lines drawn traced out of coloring books, and then after that, my grandmother used to sew samplers all the time. So her whole house was full of them. And so doing cross-stitch samplers, that was sort of the bread and butter of my very young youth. So that has such a dear spot for me. And I love seeing that there's a bit of a resurgence of it now. I'm very excited about this as well because it's such I have such a soft spot in my heart for that sort of work.
Yes, doing samplers, it goes back for me as well. When I grew up, in Wilmington, Delaware's Little Italy. And my Italian neighbors used to come outside in the summertime and sit on the porch. My next-door neighbor, Frances Pacelli, she would bring her stuff out, and she'd sit in a rocking chair, and she'd stitch on the designs that were printed on like doilies, towels, aprons, tablecloths, pillowcases, things like that. And I used to just love sitting there watching her because it was amazing to me. And I was really, really little when I would watch her do this. But I couldn't wait for summer times to just sit there and watch her. And eventually she ended up giving me a piece of muslin and gave me a pencil, and I drew a flower, and she put it in a one of those steel spring hoops for me.
That's the way. That's how you did it. Yep.
And she taught me how to do a stem stitch around the outside of the outline, and then fill it in the middle with straight stitches. Of course, I'm sure that they weren't the best looking things, but to me, I felt like I really did something. And to be honest with you, that's what planted the seed for loving needlework from that moment on. My mother was also an avid stitcher, but she had very little time to teach me when I was young because my father died when I was 5 and she was busy, providing for the family. So, but when, as the years went by, my mother remarried and she picked up her stitching again. And she taught me many, many things. She was instrumental in helping me develop my skills and taught me many things about all types of needlework, including sewing, knitting, crewel, needlepoint, you name it. My mom did it and she passed it on to me. Her favorite form of needlework was crewel. And mm-hmm. in the late 1980s, my mother was a Franciscan, and she stitched a banner of St. Francis Assisi for the Cathedral Church of St. Peter's that's in downtown Wilmington. And they still have it on display today and use it on Sundays. So it's an honor that.
That's pretty neat. That's pretty neat.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah. yes, it's a wonderful thing to me to know that her stuff is still out there.
You learned initially from your neighbor and then your mother. Did you keep stitching all through your teen years?
So you never really
stopped, huh?
No, I've always liked doing needlework. I don't know what it is. It's just something I've enjoyed. I didn't start designing right away, but I guess in a way I did because, like I said, I drew my own little flower and my
right,
neighbor
yeah, you
put
were
it in the
you,
hoop.
You were a designer. You were a designer right out of the gate.
Well, actually, you know, when I was in grade school, they were building a new rectory for the priest. And I was in third grade, and they had a contest to get money to make for the students to make a poster that would make people want to donate money for building the rectory. And I got the first prize, which was 10 silver dollars for my poster.
Whoa.
It said, "From this to this, we will build this." And I drew a picture of a hand. Going in like a piggy bank with a quarter and then a pledge card and then the picture of the rectory. And I got first prize for it. So I've always been artistic in one way or another.
Yeah. Yeah. So what did you then do some kind of art school or did you just?
I've never had any kind of training. I'm self-taught in almost everything that I do, to be honest with you. I've been able to pick things up pretty easily when it comes to needlework and art.
So you're one of those disgusting natural artists. Okay. Okay, fine.
Well, they have a fair in Delaware years ago that was called the Rodney Square it was an art show, and I sold paintings there, and I've, like I said, I've never had any training in art or anything like that. So I started doing oil paintings and just from things. When you go to places and you see art and you admire it and you think to yourself, I think I'd like to try that. In those days, I was brave, you know, and I would just, like, go buy a canvas and go get some oils and just start doing it.
And just try, right? That's fearlessness.
She knows no fear.
That's it. You can't be afraid to fail. That's sort of a recurring theme I think we've had is if you're not afraid to fail at something, then mm-hmm. you're free to do anything, right? Because then it doesn't matter. Whatever the outcome is, you're completely independent of it, and then you're free to do anything you want.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
That's right. Well,
so,
you asked.
Okay. Well, first we have to talk about what we're working on.
Okay.
So, Christine, is the hat still being knitted?
The hat is still, yes, my endless hat.
Teresa, this has been a three or four show thing, Christine.
Uh-huh. It has. And part of it is just a lack of time to put into it because I have, you know, other things to do besides stitching and knitting. So I'm still working on the hat. That's my thing.
Okay, well,
but I'm committed to finishing it though.
Before next winter.
And I'm not jumping from project to project like some other people. So that's really what it is.
I don't know anybody who does that.
No, not at all. Well, see, and the thing is, I've been getting home from work at 7 or 7:30 at night, and then, you know, we're doing this, and then by the time, and I have a child, and, you know, that kind of gets in the way of having time to sit and do this kind of work every day. So, yeah, and I'm not the fastest knitter, and I've probably torn it out 3 times already. So, you know, little mitigating circumstances. I'll own that.
As long as it's by next winter, we'll be fine.
It's going to be so great when it's done. That's all I'm saying.
And hopefully we'll have a cold enough winter that you'll be able to wear it.
Oh, I'll wear it anyway. I'm wearing it every day.
Sweat dripping down her face.
That is right.
I have put Lady Edith aside.
Okay.
And I'm going to go back and work on a couple of Christmas ornaments. Because I have one from Eileen Gurek, is a member of our local Needlework Guild, and she is a designer too. And her company is Hand Blessings. And at the Guild Christmas party, she gave us all a thing called a Freckled Damask, D-A-M-A-S-K, Christmas Puff. And it's this little square that you stitch, and then you gather up the corners and tie them together at the top with a bow, and you have a little ornament. So mm-hmm. I'm going to, I have that about a third stitched. So it was sitting there, and I thought I'm just going to go finish that thing off. So that's my project for the next week or so, and then back to Lady Edith. So, yeah, but thought I'd have a diversion. Yes. Okay, Teresa, what are you working on?
Well, I'm working on a scarf, which is one of those mitered scarves, and it goes in like a spiral.
Oh, yeah, I love
and I'm
that.
And I'm using sock yarn, the self-striping kind.
And
I'm almost finished. It was a Christmas gift. It's still now it's going to be for next Christmas because I had a little, you know, hiccup along the way this year.
It was a gift to you, not a gift you were going to give away.
It was for someone else.
Oh,
no, it was for someone else.
I thought it was a gift to you from, you know, a kind family member or something.
No.
So you
it's
missed the
I'm
deadline.
Making. Yes, I did. So every time I see the person, I pull it out and show her. I'm still working on it. Next Christmas, her birthday's May 10th, so I should have it done by then, and I'm just going to give it to her then.
There you go.
Well, and working in sock yarn, it's going to take a long time, too. It's not like
you're working
in a bulky weight where you can, you know, knit that up in 3 hours watching, you know, some binge thing on Netflix, you know?
Yes, it's on size 3 needles, so it's...
Yes, it's going to take forever.
But it is really pretty. It's I love the design.
It's beautifully delicate.
Yes. And I'm also working on a sampler that I designed for the Georgia Sampler Guild several years ago. And I'm finishing that up because I got behind stitching that as well. And that's almost done. So those are the two big projects I'm working on right now.
Okay.
As well as a design that I'm not stitching right now, but I'm working on a design for I want to design samplers for the 13 original colonies, and I want to do my New Jersey one next. So I'm getting things together that I'm researching right now to pull it together and then design it. So that's also something that's going on right now.
Boy, busy. Busy. Okay, so we got to talk about these samplers. Now, I'll tell you my little story. I have, I've done cross stitch a lot, but I've been on an extended hiatus because I got a Christmas stocking that I finished for my son. It only took 28 years to do because I kept putting it off. I kept putting it off because it was one of those, I forget the designer, but it was in, cross stitch and country crafts a long time ago. Incredibly detailed stocking, and there was a series of them, and they actually made a book out of it. So when I got done with that, I was so burnt out on cross stitching, I just put it, you know, no more for a while. But I came across an antique sampler. It's a North England sampler, And the girl who stitched it is Sarah Parr, S-A-R-A-H, Parr, P-A-R-R.
I know the sampler that you're talking about. You do. It's gorgeous.
Well, see, wow. that's our daughter's name, Sarah Parr.
Oh, my goodness.
That's her maiden name. So when I saw that, I latched onto the chart.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we were going to talk to you, I remembered I had that, and so I hauled it out. And mm-hmm. so you know this chart then?
Oh, yes, I do. I've seen it stitched many times, too. There's lots of places on the Internet that they have forums and things like that, and people will post pictures of their finished samplers. And there's quite a few that have finished that design.
Oh, well, I'll have to look it up now. Okay.
Well, I will be happy to send you a link to some of those sites so that you can look them up and see it finished. People have changed the thread colors. There's a shop in Mesa, Arizona called The Attic, and
yes.
they do special thread packages and linen packages for specific samplers, and that was one of them that they did a whole kit for you with over-dyed flosses and things like that that give it an antique look.
Oh, because that's where I got the chart, was at The Attic.
Oh, well, there you go.
But it was just the chart, and mm-hmm. and they actually shipped it to my needlework store here because they were the only ones that had access. So I didn't know they would also put together a thread pack for me.
Oh yeah, they do the thread pack too.
Oh.
Gene Lee is the owner
yes.
of this. Yes, I've been to Mesa to teach there at her. You know, she has a symposiums every year and
right.
classes and things like that. So I taught there. A year and a half ago.
Well, that's just even more interesting now. Because I'm
Gene
going to...
Gene Lee was actually the person that put me on the map, to be honest with you.
Oh.
She really was. When I first started designing, I didn't even... I wasn't going to go professional. I didn't feel... It's not that I didn't think my designs were... good enough or weren't good enough or anything. I just didn't feel like I had what it took to run a business or anything like that. And I wasn't sure that I wanted to, I like designing and I like stitching, but I didn't want to get into the business end of it.
Yeah.
But what happened is I had gone to a sampler symposium at the Maryland Historical Society. I guess it was about 2009, and I saw a sampler there called the Margaret Ogle sampler, and I had never seen a sampler like it before. It had a vertical alphabet in it, and it had three borders, one within in the other, like three borders. So, but, and it was so different looking. And I said to my friend that I was with, I said, oh gosh, I hope somebody reproduces that. I said, because normally I don't like reproductions, because you have to, when you do a really true reproduction, you have to stitch the mistakes that they make. If you make, if you don't stitch the mistakes, then it's no longer reproduction. It's called an adaptation. So what's the use? The way I look at it, if the person that stitched it originally could come back and stitch it over again, they wouldn't stitch the mistakes, would they?
No.
Right. They'd make new ones.
Right. Yes, they would, but they wouldn't stitch the ones they knew they made.
No.
So I wouldn't, I just like, it doesn't make sense to me stitching a reproduction on some levels. And there are purists that are really like they'll make those mistakes and do it proud. But at any rate, no one ever reproduced the sampler. It's a private owner that has the sampler and did not want to release it for reproduction.
Oh.
So I said to my friend, I said, if no one ever reproduces it, I'm just going to do my own take on it. And that's how I ended up with designing the Maryland Inspiration Sampler. And that was the first sampler I ever designed. It was my first time I ever entered anything in a contest. I don't know if you're familiar with the Woodlawn Plantation.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Have you been there, Christine?
No, I haven't.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I got to go there once.
Yeah. Well, I put it in there. It was the first sampler I ever did, my own design. My first time I ever exhibited anything or entered it in anything, and I got the Frank Lloyd Wright Award for Outstanding Original Design, which to a needleworker is like getting the Academy Award.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Now, see, I didn't. I just got to go there. I didn't go there for the annual needlework thing. I mean, don't let me mislead.
Okay.
But that's supposed to be amazing, though, that whole.
It is. It's very nice. And I was very honored. I was like blown away just by the fact that I, you know,
your
right
first
out
one.
The gate. Yes. Beginner's luck. I don't know. But there were people there that worked for her that were at the exhibit and saw the sampler. And there were other people that, you know, because lots of designers go to that exhibit. It's a big thing. And people that stitch go there. So she was told about it. Jean Lee was. And she contacted me and asked me if I would be interested in having my sampler be sampler of the month for her shop. And I said, I don't even have a company. I mean, you know, I mean, I just did it for my own edification. It had nothing to do with going professional or anything like that. But she talked me into it, this because I won in March, and we decided on October. It took me that long to get around to saying I would do it. And, of course, then you have to print the charts and do all of that stuff. And I just was very I didn't know anything about the business end of samples and, you know, having a company or anything like that. I'm still not good at it because it's not my line of expertise. Like I said before, I like to design. I like to stitch. I'm just a stitcher like the next guy. That's why I feel funny teaching, because I feel like everybody knows what I already know and they could probably teach me something. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Sometimes those are the best classes, though, aren't they?
Yep.
But anyway, that's how I got on the map. Jean Lee really pushed me, and she's been a big help to me right from the beginning.
So basically, you got strong-armed into this. Okay.
In a way, yes.
Yeah. Well, she is an antique sampler freak out there. I mean, the time went in the store, I was just amazed because she had several. I quit counting after a while. Where she would have the antique sampler and then the reproduction next to it. And so you got to, and it was fascinating. It was ancient old pieces of cloth that had been preserved. That's just amazing.
Yes.
Yeah. So, okay. So you say the one that inspired your design, the person wouldn't let it go. I mean, where do people find these samplers? Is it just old estate sales and,
well, you know, their sampler, you can find them in a lot of places. I have a friend who belongs to my local needlework guild, the Delaware Valley Historic Sampler Guild, and her aunt died, and she and a cousin went to the aunt's to, you know, get things out of the house, you know, so they could sell the house, and they found an old chest in the attic, and there was a box in there. And the cousin opened it, and she said, oh, this is just some junk. We'll throw it away. So my friend Sandy said, no, let me look at it. And she looks, and there were three antique samplers in there.
My.
And one of them is extraordinarily beautiful. Oh, just absolutely beautiful. And, I mean, just that's just an example how some people find them. And there are sampler dealers. You can find samplers all over the place. You have to be careful, though, because there are people that'll take an old sampler, and because of thread loss, they'll put new stitches in it. And with the fibers they have nowadays, you can't tell what's old and new for the most part, because it looks old already. You know, so you can trick people, and people that aren't familiar don't know. Wait a minute. I thought I turned my phone off, but I didn't.
That's all right.
Sorry.
So it's it's like any art, buyer beware then.
Yes, you have to be careful. And I would suggest if you were really interested in buying it, especially as an investment or something like that, that you would have somebody that's an expert do some research for you on it before you pay the money, you know, for it.
Are these things, the main body of these things generally in good shape? I expect the edges to be pretty beat
up. It depends on where.
It always depends. I hate that.
Where it was from. When I did my research for the Georgia sampler, the one that I did for Georgia, it's called A Time Forever Gone. I did a lot of research.
My favorite too. So pretty.
Oh, did you like that?
I did. It's absolutely stunning.
Yes, I write my own verses too, so I'll have to tell you a story about that in a minute. But at any rate, what was I saying? So you have to remind me now.
Georgia, working
the research
on the Georgia
you were
project.
Doing.
Yes, in the research, I couldn't find any Georgia samplers. And it was because of this Civil War, a lot of it. They were destroyed. And this was in Atlanta, so I was looking specifically in that area, and of course they burned Atlanta down. and the people in the South will remind you, are you either of you from the South? I don't want to offend
anybody.
No.
They take it very seriously still. It was the war of Northern aggression.
Yes,
that is
but
true.
At any rate, they do take it seriously. But I have to say, when I wrote the verse, I had a heart for the South in writing that verse. It just like came to me in such a way that I felt like I was Southern. Of course, watching Gone with the Wind 5 times helped too.
Yeah. Yes, that, certainly.
What is the verse that's on that one?
It goes... A soft wind blows through the Spanish moss that hangs from the live oak trees, the trees that line the long road home to distant memories of a fine old house with columns tall and porches all around, where the sweet scent of magnolia blooms in the spring abound. A lady fair in a flowery gown, silk ribbons in her hair, sweetly smiles at her courting beaux who look so debonair. And in the distance o'er the knoll, I can almost hear the song, like a choir of angels singing low of a time forever gone.
Oh, that's very nice. Wow.
So I recited that.
And you went into narrator voice to do it. That was cool.
But anyway, in my research, I couldn't find any Georgia samplers or anything. So I had to really come up with something in my own head to put together a sampler that I felt would represent what a Georgia sampler would have looked like at that time. A young lady's sampler that knew a little bit about needlework and wasn't just doing a marking sampler, which was the ones that are, you know, letters and numbers and maybe a little duck or something at the bottom. But they were the rudimentary ones that children learned in the very beginning when they were real young. Although I've seen samplers that were stitched by 8-year-olds that look like that a person that's accomplished right now couldn't stitch, really.
Right. Well, this one that I have, this Sarah Parr one, she was 10 years old when she stitched it.
Yes.
And I have to say, you know, I'm not going to be bored. Yeah.
That stitched is just absolutely gorgeous. You'll be thrilled with it when it's done.
I'm going back to Phoenix at the end of May, so I'll have to go to the attic and see it then.
Yes.
But okay, so you help me out here, because that's something I wanted to learn from you. You say that the basic samplers that were just the alphabet and numbers are called marker samplers?
Marking samplers.
Okay.
Yes. Marking samplers were done. Little girls were groomed to know how to run a household for the most part. And way back in the day, you had to know how to mark your linens. If you look at, like in England, when they would do their ledgers with the household items, linens were actually passed down through generations almost. And so that's how, you know, they had to know how to mark their linens with numbers and letters and things like that.
So they learned, okay, well, now let me put this in perspective, because a week or so ago, Mary Corbett had a thing on her site where she talked about these little thin copper things where initials and numbers were cut out that mm-hmm. you would use to mark a piece of cloth and then stitch it. So
yeah,
you're talking about that kind of thing then.
Well, that was a template that they used, the little copper templates.
Okay.
Yes, you could use that. But most of the linens were linen. So you can count your threads over. You didn't mm-hmm. have to mark it.
Oh, okay.
You would just each two squares up and two squares over equal a square, a linen square, as you know, if you're stitching on linen. I don't think, when I originally started stitching, my samplers were printed on cloth, Columbia, Minerva, those things. I would buy them in the five and dime store. And then as I progressed on, they came out with Aida cloth. And they were easy to stitch on because you had your squares clearly marked.
Right.
You know, you could see them, but you couldn't do fractional stitches on those. Like you can on linen. You
right.
can do fractional stitches there. And you could do specialty stitches on linen that you can't do on Aida cloth.
Weren't these young girls also working on their trousseau for their wedding? That was part of it?
Well, I have a little bit written about it. It says the children were taught reading and arithmetic, and in some cases, both sexes participated in knitting, sewing, and sampler making instruction. It was part of the responsibility to learn how to sew clothes and linens for her future family, and most mm-hmm. girls completed at least two samplers in their lifetime. The first was called a marking sampler. It says marking samplers served a dual purpose. They taught a child basic embroidery techniques and the alphabet and numbers. The mm-hmm. letters and numbers learned while embroidering a marking sampler were especially useful, since it was important that any homemaker keep track of her linens, some of which were her most valuable household goods.
Mm.
I'm just reading this now. I was reciting what I knew from, but you know, it sounds a lot better when it's written down. But at any rate, and then the second sampler was usually something that you could show off. It was framed, it was hung on the wall, and any potential suitors that came to the house could see that you were a lady of, you were
some talent.
Yes. And usually samplers, especially if you were making a really nice sampler, they were reserved for people of means.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't like the little girl that lived down on the other side of the tracks that was making samplers in those days, you know, unfortunately. But
And what were they using for linen, and then what were they using for thread? Just cotton, dyed cotton?
Silks,
okay.
Yeah, and a lot of the dyes way back in the day had carbon-based and iron to make it black, and that's why you'll find antique samplers where the thread is missing and you could still see what was printed because the black dye from the iron will imprint itself on the linen. In a lot of cases, it actually eats away at the linen and will leave a hole because it's a corrosive material. So and that all depends on the way samplers are stored. If you see, there are some older samplers that are so washed out, you can't tell what color it was stitched with because it's just so pale. Sometimes if you turn it over, if you are able to get access to the back, you can see the colors. But it's because people would store them or hang them on the wall where sun was shining in, and the sun will fade. It's like a horrible thing for a sampler.
Right.
I know most needlework guilds make donations to museums and places like that so that they can conserve old textiles and prevent them from deteriorating any further. We just made a donation to the Newcastle County Historical Society, $1,000 donation for their conservation efforts towards samplers. So our guild did, the Delaware Valley Historic Sampler Guild. But most guilds do that. I've designed two Christmas ornaments for guilds, one in Utah and one in Boston, for them to use the monies they made off of selling it to donate for conservator purposes.
Yeah.
Conservation purposes.
Now, when they get these samplers and you do these reproductions, I've read that that's one way to tell the thread colors is to turn it over if you can get to the back side of that thing.
Mm-hmm,
but then in true reproductions, you know, if you're following the rules, it seems like everybody always works on like a tea dyed stained cloth, something to make it look old. Is that the standard thing? Is to use to use non-white cloth, off-white cloth?
It depends on the designer that's reproducing. Some people will reproduce on what they consider the fabric looked like originally.
Okay.
Other people want it to look old, so they'll use an overdyed. That's what they call it, overdyed linen. There are a couple of companies that specialize in overdyed linens. Lakeside Linen, you may be familiar with them. I buy all my linens from them because I really like their linens. Plus, I like to stitch on fine linen, like 40 count, mm-hmm. which is 40 threads to the inch. And because I like, and I like to stitch with overdyed flosses because I like the way it looks on the linen, the higher count linens, because it saturates the color better and mm-hmm. it gives it more of an antique look because the colors fade in and out along the row.
Oh, okay.
You know what I mean?
I think in the Georgia piece that shows off really nicely, especially in the trees.
Mm-hmm.
You can really see that effect.
Yes. So
that's generally the approach then, is you want it, the finished piece, to look old and antique to mm-hmm. some degree, rather than this is an old design and we make it look fresh and bright and new.
Right. I don't want my stuff to look fresh, bright, and new. I want it to look like it's got some age to it, even though it is fresh, bright, and new.
Oh, okay. Well,
what I do is I usually pick, when I decide what I want to design, I get like a concept in my head, and then I'll think of the color of the linen that I want to use. And I usually go with a vintage linen, which means that it's overdyed. It's like a solid color, and then they put a color on top of it to give it that antique look. And I'll do a floss toss of the colors that I think I want to use in the design. If they don't look good on my linen, then I'll pull it off and I'll put a different color there until I find the combination that I feel is going to work with it, and that's what I go with. One of the things about my design process is that I am my own model stitcher because I actually design as I stitch in many cases. I might design something on with my software, but as I'm stitching it, I just don't like the way it looks, so I'll change it as I'm going along. And that's part of my the way I design. So I can never use a model stitcher because of that.
Okay, I want to back you up because I think it is so cool what you do, where you're taking these antique designs and using them as inspiration. So mm-hmm. when we, you know, and I was, that was one of the questions that I asked, do you design on the fly or do you design and then stitch? And it sounds like it's a combination, but do you look at these samplers and pull off little motifs and say, I think I can use this one or this one, or what is inspiration to you when you look at these old samplers? Just an overall design? What is it that makes you put something together?
Well, to be honest, you know, sometimes it's usually something I see in the sampler. There's like a house. I like houses and samplers, and I'll see a house. I like stone houses, you know, so that'll inspire me. just driving down the road, my sampler that I did called Stonehouse on the Brandywine, I grew up in this area, you know, the Brandywine River Valley area, and there are many, many stone houses in that area. And when my children were young, I used to take them for rides out in the country, and we would pass these stone houses, and I used to think to myself, boy, what a story they could tell if they could talk, you know, because they had been there since the Revolutionary War. And so it's things like that. Even a flower can inspire me. I did a design for the Bay Area Sampler Guild, which is out in San Francisco, and they wanted something that reflected you know, the pilgrims or the pioneers that made their way out west. And I couldn't find any samplers in California that to use to inspire me, because most of those were Mexican style samplers. And the people that made their way out west, they really didn't have time to stitch. You know what I'm saying?
They were trying to stay alive, yeah.
Yes, so there really wasn't much to go by. So I came up with my own design, and what I did was I picked out flowers that were indigenous to the area, and I did my own representation of what that stitched flower would look like, and I incorporated them in a border, and I wrote a verse for that one, which was very simple and very short. It just says, and so they came, sojourners all, praying for providence while heeding the call. And I did a band in the center of it.
I'm looking at it right now. Oh, wow.
Yeah, that has Mexican motifs in it. It has Irish motifs in it. So I tried to take the peoples of the East that went out west, and also the people from Russia that came in the other direction, and China that came from the other direction to that particular part of the country, and incorporate them in the bands that I designed to go in the sampler. And then, of course, on the bottom, I have the checkered deer, which were very popular in Mexican samplers.
Oh.
And so I did the deer with a little humor in mind, because it's like Adam and Eve deer.
Oh, there you go.
Adam and Eve deer. If you look, the one deer is looking, and she has the apple.
Yep.
And then the other deer is turned, and he dropped his pear. I think he had a pear in his mouth, because he heard something in the bushes. So the only one that had anything left was Eve. So she shared her apple. So that's my
okay.
My take on humor in my sampler.
Yeah, but I can see the melting pot of designs of styles in here. That's really mm-hmm. neat when you point it out.
Yes, yes. And I try to do that in all my samplers. When I was asked to do the Delaware sampler, there was a sampler that I had found just looking at antique samplers from Delaware, which at the time there were no real samplers found. Now they found a lot of samplers from Delaware, because they've been doing these workshops where people bring samplers in, and I'm sending you information, or I sent you information on that was through the Sampler Consortium. But they had all of these projects where they did archives, workshops. And there's a book being written right now by Gloria Seaman Allen on Delaware samplers because of it. But I was asked to design a sampler to teach at the Biggs Museum in Dover, Delaware. And they asked me to design something that would represent an antique sampler in Delaware. So I found a sampler that I really loved that was from the fruit and flower design style that was popular in the late 1700s, early 1800s in Newcastle County, Delaware. And that's what I used as my footprint for my design. But I incorporated all the little state symbols in my sampler of Delaware.
Okay.
Like there's a butterfly in there, tiger swallowtail butterfly, which is our state butterfly. Our state insect is the ladybug. our state wildlife is the gray fox, so that's in the sampler. You know, so there's elements of the state tree, the state flower, the state fruit, but I incorporated it all in the footprint of the antique. So it's like an antique sampler, but yet it's of a modern, there's a modern take on it, but it still looks antique.
Yeah.
And our state bird is the blue hen. So I have like a rooster and a hen down at the bottom of the sampler. I don't know if you can see that as well with what I sent you, but that was a very popular design.
So, okay, so you and you said you're working on one for each of the original 13 colonies. Is that, did I recall that
right.
correctly?
So yeah. I have Delaware done, I have Maryland done, I have Pennsylvania done, and I have Georgia done. New Jersey's my next one that I'm going to do.
Okay.
And hopefully, you know, I'll be able to get them all done. But, you know, in fact, the Georgia, the sampler from New Jersey is based on a style from Burlington County. I don't know if you're familiar with Betty Ring. She was a historian and a scholar on antique samplers.
No.
And she was a collector. And in 2011, her family, because she was failing in health and she was in a nursing facility, and her family decided to sell her collection, and they sold it through Sotheby's. And we were able to get the actual sale on the internet through the computer, and we put it on somebody's TV set. So we went to her house and we sat there with fake paddles.
And watched it, right?
But there was this one sampler called the Mary Antrim sampler that was in her collection, and it was a Burlington County sampler. And I said to everybody right off, I said, that is going to sell for $1 million. And everybody said, yeah, right, you know, whatever. And I said, I swear it is, because it was just gorgeous. And it sold for over $1 million.
Wow.
And so I'm going to use that kind of like my footprint for what I'm going to design for my New Jersey sampler.
$1 million for a sampler. That's impressive. Wow.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
And when was the sampler dated from? Was it dated?
Let me see. I want to say 1790, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure. I think it was later than that. It might have been 18. I could look it up if you want me to, but
no, I was just curious, even just generally. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. Hmm. It's a beautiful sampler, and you, like most samplers from specific areas, they had teachers that taught in certain areas of the country, especially on the East Coast. And you can tell where a sampler's from, because there'll be several samplers that are very similar in style and design. Mm-hmm. And you could say, oh, like in Rhode Island, they have samplers that came from the Balk School. And you always can tell that's a Rhode Island sampler. That's a Balk School sampler. You could tell just by the way it's laid out, the whole thing. That's a Balk School sampler. Just like the one from the Delaware sampler that I designed. I don't know who the teacher was, but I know that that was a Newcastle County fruit and flower design sampler style that came from that specific area.
Hmm.
You know, so just like Quaker samplers.
Yeah.
You know, they all have like a specific look to them, a specific style.
I got to interrupt you there on Quaker samplers, because that's something I want to make sure I ask you. Those are so different in the way that they're put together. Did they literally come from the Quaker people, or how did they evolve to be such a different kind of sampler?
Well, I'm not really sure. Like I said, I'm not a scholar, but just in studying what I've studied about them, they were just medallions, they called them.
And, oh, okay.
Yeah. So, and if you look at German samplers, old German samplers, they're called CELLE, and I call them CELLE, but I'm sure I'm not pronouncing it correctly. But there's this sampler style called CELLE samplers, and they all have medallions on them. And I think they evolved from that, but I'm not sure. Like I said, I'm not a scholar, but they look very much like what a Quaker sampler evolved into.
Okay.
But in England at the Ackworth School is where the Quaker samplers originated from, in that area, the Ackworth School. And they just had a huge thing over there in like 2006 or 7, where they did people actually got to stay at the Ackworth School, and they had a huge symposium, and they wrote books about it. I sent you in the packet that I sent you information about Needleprint. Needleprint was the company that published the books about the Ackworth samplers, and also they are the ones that were involved in getting the Ackworth symposium together.
Oh, okay. Okay.
There's a school in Delaware.
Go ahead.
There is a school in Delaware, not Delaware, but in Pennsylvania, the Westtown School, and they have a huge collection of Quaker samplers there. They have Quaker samplers, Quaker pinballs. They have the Quaker globes that the girls used to stitch. They're shaped like an actual globe and have, like, you know, the world on it stitched on.
Oh my!
It's amazing. If you ever get a chance to come out here, it would be worth going to the Westtown School to see those things.
Wow, it's just fascinating to me. It's just a complete other world of this.
Yeah.
And all the people that have studied it. I mean, I can just tell from you. You say you're not a scholar. You know an awful lot for not being a scholar. But you know, and from what you know, that tells me there's other people probably have spent their entire lives just researching this stuff.
They have. Not just researching it, but they research the families, the history of the girl who stitched the sampler. Mm-hmm. They go way back and get all the information they can get on them. It's really, really interesting. And we've had quite a number of speakers come to our guild and talk about, you know, their research and things they did. You know, because we're close to Winterthur, so we've had speakers from Winterthur come over and talk to our group. And because of the sampler archive project that I was talking about earlier, we've had a number of people that are working on that. In fact, that's how I got involved in designing the Delaware sampler, was through the sampler archive project. So, you know, because they wanted to feature Delaware samplers at the Biggs Museum in Dover. So they not only had the symposium there, but they also had classes, and I taught my Delaware sampler there.
Oh. What are the rules? There must be some rules for samplers. Do they always have to have a verse or an alphabet?
No.
Are there some basic things, or is it just whatever you want to put in them?
Whatever you want to put in it. I mean, my sampler, the Queen City Sampler, I designed that for the Queen City Sampler Guild in Cincinnati, and I just pulled that together. It has no verse in it or anything, but I had so much fun designing that sampler. In my research, I found a panoramic picture that was taken in 1848 of the Cincinnati waterfront with the steamboats and the warehouses, and I used that along the bottom of the sampler in part of my design. There was also a sampler that was stitched in Ohio that had all of these, like the plot of land, and all of the houses were stitched in on the plot with the house number. I can't remember the name of the person offhand, but I use that as an inspiration for part of the sampler. I also did a lot of research in using the book Ohio is My Dwelling Place, which was written by Sue Studebaker. She's now deceased. But she had a lot of information in her book, and she talked a lot about the schools that were out there in those days for girls to learn needlework. And I named some of the institutions. I did my own rendition of what I thought the school might look like. One of the schools was Mrs. Wozencraft. That was her name, and she had a needlework academy. And she's featured in a huge house that's depicted on this sampler. Another thing that comes out of Ohio and Pennsylvania, places like that, are the overshot blankets. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I don't know that.
They're like coverlets that are woven. But anyway, I feature that in the sampler, as well as quilts and, you know, just a lot of things. I just put things that come into my head. There are state flowers, the carnation, and that's featured across the top. At one time, Cincinnati was known for their grapes. They used to produce a wine there called Catawba wine, and they grew the grapes, and they had were known worldwide for their wine production. And I did one whole side of the sampler with grapes coming down in the border.
Yeah,
and then on the other side, I put the Quaker medallions because Ohio was really integral in the Underground Railroad, mm-hmm. and they were Quakers, and so I wanted to pay homage to the Quakers for that. So that's how it just comes into my head, and things just, like, start to evolve.
Okay, but I have to this may be a dumb guy question, I don't know, but you have at the top Cincinnati – H.C. Ohio. What's H.C.?
Hamilton County.
Oh, okay. All right.
Now, I designed that for their 20th anniversary, Queen City Sampler's 20th anniversary, at the request of a friend of mine who was also a designer. Her name is Ellen Chester, and she designs under With My Needle. I don't know if you're familiar with
her. Don't know that one, no. Mm-mm.
Yes. But she asked me if I would do it, and I said yes. And I have her name, her initials on the sampler, as well as Sue Studebaker's, because they were, like, inspiring to me as I stitched that sampler.
Yeah.
Because I stitched it for those, you know. Anyway.
So now, when you do these samplers, what generally, what size do you work with? It looks like they're all – a similar size?
They're pretty big. Well, the Georgia sampler, the Cincinnati sampler, and the Maryland Inspiration sampler are huge. They're big samplers. But the Delaware's...
Huge being what, 18, 20 inches on a side?
They're about 24 square.
Oh, my.
That's pretty big.
20. I might be exaggerating a little bit because I'm thinking of the frame by the time it's framed. They're probably more like 21 or 22. I don't like to use matting on my projects, so I don't have to factor that in. I only have to factor in the size of the frame.
Yeah.
But my Delaware sampler, that's not really that big, and one that I did, I call it Sojourner. That's the one I did for San Francisco. That's not that big. But everything I do has a lot of stitching in it.
Yes.
Because it's packed.
Yes.
So if you want to stitch one of my samplers, you're going to have to really like to stitch, and you're going to have stick-to-itiveness. Because even I have to have stick-to-itiveness after a while. Stitching my own stuff.
Yeah. Now, what for thread, what do you use? Do you use DMC floss for the most part, or do you use silks?
No,
what do you use?
No, I use silks. I love silks. Honestly, once you start using silks, it's very difficult to go back to cotton. And I guess I'm a little bit stuck up on that. I don't know if that's the word. But I've become spoiled in that regard. And also with the linen, I could never go back to Ada cloth since I've stitched on linen. I can't even imagine it at this point. But and there's nothing wrong with anybody that does stitch on that. I'm just saying what my preference is.
Right.
I want to clarify that. But what was I going to say?
Well, so the silks.
But I do stitch with silks, and I use a specific silk that I really like, and it's made, used to be called Belsoir.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And it's made by Classic Colorworks is the name of the manufacturer. And that's what I use, and I love their silks. It's a 12-stranded silk. So even though it costs a lot more, you're getting twice as much as you would get in a strand of DMC.
Right, right.
So
and most of your designs are what, two threads over two, or what do you normally do?
Because I stitch on higher count linen, I only use one thread.
Okay.
It goes a long way. It does go a long way.
Yeah.
But of course, my designs, like I said, have a lot of stitching in them, so you're using quite a bit of thread over entire stitching. I sent you a picture of the design. I won a best of show at the Rehoboth Historical Society. I entered it in their competition or their needlework exhibition this year, and I got best of show. But it's a I love Pennsylvania German frock doors. I've always loved them. I just think they're beautiful with their naive artwork and are you familiar with what they are?
No. You're sharing all new worlds to us here.
Well, honestly, they're just beautiful, just beautiful. And the Schwenkfelder Museum, who's having this upcoming event, the Penn Dry Goods Market, they are the they have the largest collection of Pennsylvania German Frochter in the country. So every now and again, they have a big exhibit there. And if you make reservations in advance, you might be able to get a private showing even of what they have. Mm. But there are many, many books on Pennsylvania German Frochter. But my design for the piece that got best of show was based on Pennsylvania German Frochter. They're like certificates that they used to make for baptisms and marriages and certificates of merit for a child in school who got good grades or, all kinds of things. And I wanted to do something that was based on the accomplishment of a stitcher. And that's what I did. I did a Huswif, which is like a folding needlework case that women used to keep in their pockets, and they carried it with them everywhere because you always had to sew something back in the day.
Right.
And I had a man make me the bird's eye maple stand that it goes in. And then I have a sewing set inside of the stand. So you have one to take with you and one to keep on your stand at home, to keep all your little needlework things in.
Yep. Now, when you stitch, I assume you use a stand, you use a scroll frame or what?
Nope.
How do you
stitch in hand? I stitch in hand
really?
Everything. Yep, I do.
Wow. No hoop even?
No hoop. The only time I use a hoop is if I'm doing French knots, because you have to have tension.
Right.
French knot. And sometimes I'll do it when I'm doing over one. If I'm doing over one and I have color changes in it, I want to be able to see more clearly where my thread's going. And I usually do it in tense stitch rather than a full cross. But I could see better with a hoop because it pulls it apart a little bit so you can see your holes, But other than that, I stitch in hand. I love stitching in hand.
Wow.
That's why I like thick side linens, because it has a nice feel to it. It's not stiff. I mean, I've gotten linen in the past, you could, walk on it, like a stilt or something.
It's like
it
carpet
was so
linen.
Stiff. Yes. so But and they're very difficult to stitch in hand on because they're so stiff. But I really prefer stitching in hand, and I use the sewing method.
Oh, you do?
Which is like you just some people they poke the poke and and I do the sewing method.
Yeah, I'm a poker. Yep, I know what you mean. Yep, I never could understand that the sewing method. It didn't work for me. So,
But you have to stitch in hand to do the sewing method, really.
Well, maybe that's why I never got it because I've never stitched in hand. Yeah.
If you have it in a frame, it's too stiff to make your needle wrap underneath the thread and come out the other side.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or if you're stitching in hand, it's easy to do it that way. But you have to remember, you have to keep up a certain tension, and it comes with practice and skill, you know, to make your stitches look good.
Well, you can't just do this just right out of the gate, huh? Man, I can't believe it. Darn it.
So, no. No. In order for your stitches to look even and nice and tidy. Yeah. I like my stitches to look nice and tidy.
Yep. Well, that's why I like that cloth tight as I can get it. Yep.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Teresa, this has been a treat. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Can I just share one thing before I go?
Certainly.
Yes. Yeah,
okay. Well, you know, Mother's Day is coming up, and we were talking earlier about my mother. And I just wanted to share something with you about my needlework experience that relates to my mother. When I grew up in the city, first of all. So I never saw a hummingbird in person and up close and personal because I lived in the city, and we really didn't have – we may have, but I never saw one. So in the late 1980s, my husband and I moved to Middletown, Delaware, which was a rural area at the time. And our house was located over on a flyway where birds would fly to go to this area called Bombay Hook. So we had all kinds of birds coming into the yard and, you know, all kinds of things you would see that I never saw growing up in the city. So one day we were outside doing yard work, and I had gone to the market, the nursery, and I got this huge planter and a peat pot to hang on my porch, and it was fuchsia. And I hung it up, and I was resting on the bench, and I'm sitting there. And while I'm sitting there, these three hummingbirds come up, and they're hovering and darting in and out of the flowers and drinking the nectar. And I just sat there transfixed on the bench. I didn't move. I was afraid to breathe because I didn't want to chase them away. And I was just so excited. So by the time they were done and they flew away, I couldn't wait to go call my mother and tell her about it. And at the time, my mother was extremely ill. She had pulmonary fibrosis, and she was bedridden, and she was on oxygen and everything, and she was having a very difficult time. But I ran in the house, and I called her up on the phone, and I'm telling her all about it, and she's saying, oh, Teresa, she goes, that's so wonderful. I'm so glad you saw that. And she goes, I can actually see it in my own mind as you describe it. I feel like I was there. And so, you know, we ended the call. And that Christmas, my mother could not wait to give me my Christmas present. So I went over to her house, and she hands me this box, and it's shaped like a pizza box. And I opened it up, and inside the box was a framed picture, cross-stitched, of hummingbirds drinking out of a fuchsia plant.
Wow.
And my mother... who was dying, really. She died like a year and a half after this, after I told her the story, actually. She took that time because of my story, and she got her an old stitchery book out that sold kits, and she found a kit with it on there, you know, that particular design. She ordered it and spent the time to stitch that for me, and I know it was difficult for her. And on the bottom, she signed it with the word, with a heart, and then next to that, Mom. Huh. And it's one of my most prized possessions. But what she taught me, not only in the needlework she taught me, was to persevere. And it's really what has gotten me into designing today and gave me the courage to pursue my dreams. And that's the end of my story.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Wonderful. Yeah, I there's nothing to add there.
Nope.
Truly. What a gift. It's a gift of so many levels, you know?
Yes.
And the fact that you have this, and every time you look at it, not only can you think of the memory of that day, but the effort that your mom put into that piece, but everything that it told you about your relationship with her.
Mm-hmm.
And especially even going back to the very beginning of this conversation, when you were talking about how difficult it was for her at the beginning, raising a family, you know, by herself.
Right.
The fact that
right.
at the end of it, she was able to care for you just as carefully and with just as much effort, through needlework is such a beautiful circle.
Yes, it was. And it is. It still is. She inspires me to this day. Truly does. So
thank you for sharing that. That means a lot.
Yeah,
oh, you're very welcome. Yeah,
that's terrific. And that's it. We're done. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Teresa. This
you're
really,
very welcome.
It's been a privilege.
I enjoyed it. You have a great evening.
Thank you.
All right. Bye. Bye-bye.